Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nicholas Investment Insights. Today we turn our attention to the key headwinds that potentially face the enormous growth of asset prices worldwide. Record levels of emergency central bank cuts, along with huge fiscal stimulus, originally designed to support markets, appears now to be priced into assets in perpetuity, creating new anxiety that this growth is now more vulnerable to external shocks than ever. Today we'll be running through some of the key risk scenarios we see as potential things to consider using our macroeconomic narratives, entwining China, the US, some thoughts on Europe, and our views on the forecasts of the major currencies. Joining us on the line is our Chief Strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith. Hello to you, David.
G'day, Tim.
Good to have you on. And here, back here in the studio, we are also now joined by our newest member to the Nucleus Wealth team, Mark Montero. Mark has recently joined us as our new financial advisor and going forward will be chairing this show. Hello and welcome to you, Mark.
G'day, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you on. And finally, to share his thoughts on if we should be fearing the growth scare and how it may influence our portfolios, I'm joined by Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hello to you, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
And just a quick reminder before we get started, if you haven't already, subscribe and click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. And we also ask if you'd like to take a moment to click like on the video now to help our show grow. So we'll jump across to the agenda for today. Fear the growth scare, we've called our show today. We'll kick off by just saying we're looking at risk scenarios, not base cases. And as I mentioned, we'll be looking at or running through some key facts and projections for China, the US, having a look at some offsets potentially to these downsides, and then rolling through into assets. And then, as always, running through the effects on this in and how we view these in the portfolios we run here at Nucleus Wealth and the MB Fund. So with no further ado, let's jump into our first order of the day, which is China. And I'm guessing here that we'll kick off with David, as usual, for our views on China. David.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. So for context on why there's a possible role for China in a developing growth scare, we need to go back to first principles on where China is at, and that is, for many years it's had its investment-led growth model, which is, very driven by fixed asset investment, infrastructure, and property in particular. And these tend to be very debt-intensive areas of growth, and the Chinese authorities have been trying to rebalance, in inverted commas, away from these drivers of growth because they see them as, actually being destructive to living standards over the long term, because all of that accumulating debt is now building assets that really aren't needed and won't have any return. And so slowly but surely you get bogged down in what is called a middle income trap as your economy develops. So that's the context, the ongoing context for China. Now, within that context, they have, over the last decade or so, oscillated between periods of trying to deleverage those sectors of the economy and de-emphasize them in their growth, and then having to revert back to them with stimulus when growth slows too much. It threatens higher unemployment, and then that spooks the Communist Party about unrest, etc. And so we've oscillated between those two poles since GFC in 2011-12. We did a deleveraging impulse in 13-14. We did a stimulus, then 15-16, a deleveraging, then 17 or so, another stimulus, and then 18-19 back into deleveraging, and then, of course, stimulus into COVID shock of 2020. excuse me. So now our latest impulse out of China is deleveraging again. And so that's the the sort of basis upon which there's a potential growth shock or growth scare coming out of China is that they're once again trying to rebalance their economy. And that comes with several of the usual indicators, one being falling credit growth. excuse me, this time around, they sort of do it differently each time, differently but the same. This time around, they've used a lot of regulatory clamps that have been new on property, the tech sector, and education. And so that's now starting to generate some, you know, pretty serious dyspepsia in some markets. And we're seeing, if we cross the page, we'll start to have a look at some of those markets and see what it means. So we've gone from stimulus to tightening, and now we're entering a bit of a stress phase in China. So what does it look like in the various markets? So the first cab off the rank was property, and this was a new way of addressing the property market that has dogged China for many years, where prices run away, although they've been relatively constrained for the last 5 years. More to the point, they overbuild apartments, many of which are empty. And, you know, there's this perpetual investment flow from Chinese savings into these kind of pointless and unproductive apartments. So late last year, the Chinese authorities put in a new policy called Three Red Lines, which was directed at the property development sector directly. They'd never done this one before. And it was simply a bunch of caps on their possible leverage, you know, at the enterprise level. So ever since, we've started to see a slowdown in property starts in China, and, you know, we're well down on 2019, and over the coming couple of months, we'll probably be down from the 2020 big stimulus pulse as well. So that's obviously going to be a headwind for various asset classes. But that has now started to reach a point of, I guess, some acuteness. There's two features to that. We're starting to see some of these developers have been unable to deleverage as quickly as governments would like. And so that's turned into credit stress for a firm called Evergrande, which is, you know, one of the largest, in fact, used to be the largest developer in China, certainly one of the most leveraged. And that stress has started to spread in what we call contagion into the overall property sector, where it's all been smashed. It's all, equity's all been pulverized all year, but it's now heading into the debt markets that fund these developers, as well as into banks, who are starting to wonder whether they should fund some of the developments, and lots of shadow banking kind of instruments that these developers use as well. All of them are starting to show signs of stress. I've just put one up here today, which is basically the junk debt around high yield Chinese debt. And it's really starting to show up in some very high yields for these companies.
And this is a sort of a, this is one of these snowballing effects as well, because, you know, when the debts are really low for everyone, then everyone can keep rolling their debts over. And then you start getting one person have problems, or one certainly big one in terms of Evergrande starting to have some problems. And you start seeing these yields spike up, which mean there's a bunch of other companies out there that might have been all right if they were paying much lower rates of debt. But as their debt costs and rollover start to jump up, then they start to run into problems as well. And then that means that the whole, you know, up goes the yields again, and you're sort of creating that creating an issue for everyone.
Mm. Question for me, right, just Dave, is obviously China is one of our biggest trading partners. You know, what happens in China is sort of like we ride on the back of the dragon.
Reluctant trading partner.
Reluctant trading partner. Yeah, that's right. But unfortunately,
in recent years,
they're trying to change it, and we're trying to change it, but it sort of seems like we're locked in step. Is this when and just for the listeners, perhaps sake as well, when we're talking about the problems in China or potential problems in China, is this more acute for Australia, or are we actually reflecting this across sort of a global growth perspective?
Well, we'll get to those questions as we go through. I mean, I think what is most critical and most interesting to Australian listeners will simply be that Evergrande is kind of forming a singularity, a little black hole at the heart of global iron ore demand.
Right.
And we'll come back to that, I guess. But, you know, the combined demand for coming out of Chinese property development and infrastructure is about nearly 70% of Chinese steel demand. And this is why I've got local government infrastructure here, up here as a point as well. There's a huge amount of borrowing that goes on in China through special purpose vehicles that builds a lot of the infrastructure. And what has happened this year, a bit mysteriously, no one can really explain it, is that their borrowing has dropped off immensely as well. And there are various explanations put for this. You know, this is despite the fact that their centralized caps that are set by the CCP are only cut slightly on last year, but they just haven't been borrowing. They're miles behind where they were last year. And there's various proposals for or theses for why this is the case. But nobody really seems to be able to pin it down exactly. And in fact, the central government's been encouraging them to borrow more, but has been failing to get any traction. So that kind of, you know, my thesis on it is that it's possible that the three red line stuff and the stress that we're seeing in the developers has manifest in falling land prices, because, you know, some of these developers are dumping land banks and stuff to deleverage. And I do wonder if, you know, as well, the sort of, I suppose, the geographical footprint of land sales has fallen away as well. So I do wonder if, because land sales are such a large element of revenue for local governments, I wonder if that this failing revenue stream might be disrupting their balance sheets and they can't borrow as much either for infrastructure. So the point is that there seems to be some links between the local government infrastructure and the property cycle.
And some of it's also, David, is that the thought that if you're expecting an ever-increasing property prices, because property prices only ever go up, then as a local government official, then you can, there's more stuff you can commit to. You say, oh, yeah, we'll build this new bridge and this new airport and all that type of stuff. And, yeah, I haven't quite got the money now, but property prices are going to go up next year. and so some of it might just be that the three red lines are meaning like, oh, okay, well, now, you know, obviously there's three red lines trying to cap the property increases. And so when I'm looking forward at my budget, maybe I won't go build that new bridge yet. I'll wait till I get a bit more revenue and a bit more certainty before.
Yes. And there are mixed signals coming from Beijing. I say they're encouraging them to borrow. But overall, there is this push to deleverage as well. And so they're sort of being told to deleverage and to borrow at the same time. And then there's, you know, this green push in China, and there are rumours that the NDRC, which approves a lot of the infrastructure, has much higher green benchmarks now. So a lot of the projects can't get over those benchmarks.
Even just timing issues as well in terms of that. I mean, we know in most developed countries now that, you know, the time to get approvals is blown out a lot because of all these checks and you know.
Yes, it might be that too. Mm-hmm. So the bottom line is, though, right now, the deleveraging campaign in China is increasingly going to slow the commodity-intensive areas of its economy, and there's potential crisis building in the leveraged development sector. And then on top of that, we can add the recent couple of weeks where we've had, you know, these tech routes as the CCP, you know, puts to the sword any kind of firm or individual that could potentially rise in it to become too powerful, having access to, you know, so much data of the Chinese population, plus education stocks, which are from what I read, will be quite popular amongst mums and dads. That might be just a classic kind of populist policy move. But all of these things that have severely disrupted the Chinese stock markets. So, you know, it's very reminiscent of 2015, all of this, which was the last time. Well, we did see a deleveraging campaign in 2018-19, but it didn't affect Australia as much simply because we had the iron ore shortage coming out of Brazil. And so it went by largely unnoticed. But it's very reminiscent of 2015 at this point, the setup, where you have China having come out of stimulus, trying to deleverage again, and then, you know, relatively quickly ending up with all sorts of credit stress that can become systemic rather quickly. And so it then faces this Hobbesian choice of persisting and through deleveraging and actually shunting growth much lower than it wants it to be, or having to re-stimulate, which is what it's always done before, and then just kicking the can and ending up with the longer term problem of bogging down the economy into the middle income trap. So that's your classic kind of Chinese cycle, and it's where it is. It's definitely getting worse. They've started a little bit of a turn towards stimulus with their recent reserve ratio cut. And so an analogy we've been using internally recently is, you know, if you think of the Chinese economy as a large and rather heavy aircraft, they're clearly trying to glide slope it lower over time to lower growth and rebalance it. But what tends to happen is, as it goes into the glide slope, just doing things like reserve ratio cuts, things like what we saw yesterday with the plunge protection team coming out and saying, you know, Chinese stocks are okay, little bits of new credit round at the margins, you know, maybe releasing a few real estate constraints on a few cities here and there, more reverse reserve ratio cuts. There's a million different little things that they can do, repo markets, etc. And they will do them. They'll keep doing them. They try and nudge the throttle open a little more, but the plane just keeps falling because they've simply allowed too much credit into and too much power into these very heavy sectors that don't have a lot of any real return or productivity growth embedded in them. And so the plane keeps falling, even though they keep trying to nudge it higher, until they're forced to, you know, full bore open the credit throttles again, and then off it goes again. But it's a process where they have to go through this period of sort of growing panic for 6 or 12 months before, you know, the pull-up terrain siren goes off, and then they freak out, and then they juice it all heavily with heaps more credit. Mm. Now, will they do that again? Very likely. They don't seem to be able to actually take the pain of reform, you know, very much like a Western democracy. And so, you know, the likelihood is that we will go through that cycle again. But the important point to make, I guess, for assets is that they usually can't turn it until you get to the point of a growth scare. You know, they kind of have to have the scare before they fully open the throttle again.
And the other factor is part of the reason for them, you know, looking to transfer this time is because the industrial production in China has been very strong, driven by consumer demand coming out of Western countries that are developed countries that are sort of locked down or have been, you know, various stages of lockdown and haven't been able to travel, and so spending a lot more on goods, which have largely come from China. So in a way, you know, the strength in the industrial sector, they're using that strength to then say, okay, because we're growing quite well in this part, we can actually then scale back what we're doing on the other side. Now, we think that industrial side is going to turn quite quickly. We think it's an inventory super cycle, as we've spoken about, which is quite a short-term phenomenon. And we think that there's a number of ones. We're using the lumber as a good example. It's not generally a Chinese asset, but the lumber prices, you know, rose from sort of $400 a ton to $1,700 a ton, and are pretty quickly getting back towards that $400 a ton, you know, over a sort of 6 month period, in that you had this real sort of burst of demand and not enough supply, which sort of sent prices skyrocketing. But then the supply, basically people were like, at $1,700, I'm more than happy to provide as much wood as you want. So, you know, it's...
And also people, demand being paused as well. On the
exactly,
other side.
And demand, yeah, yeah. Demand coming off.
Because I'm not saying, buying that, I'll just hold off until...
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And so so that's, we think that's a, everything's on a different cycle, because some things, that same cycle will play out over 3 weeks. Other ones it's going to take, you know, 9 to 12 months to play out over. But we think that exact same cycle is occurring throughout a whole bunch of things in China right now. Mm. In that there's just been this real crush of demand, and you're going to see that the other side of that starting to come off. So we think if they're pulled back on the infrastructure and the building, because they're relying on this industrial production, and then the industrial production all starts falling quite quickly, that you then go, okay, by the time you say, okay, start turning the debt taps back on and really pushing it, there's still a hole in terms of that you've got a 6 month or 9 month
lag time
before they can actually get these things going again.
Okay. Yep. That makes sense. All right.
Excuse me. So, I mean, I guess that's a good segue into the second feature of the fear the growth scare thesis, which is, as Damo says, China's being supported by a global inventory cycle, which has, you know, been this huge fiscal drop of money on Western households, especially in the US, and that's about to end. So, you know, immediately ahead for the US, we start to get these year-on-year base effects in fiscal spending, which are going to dramatically reverse from last year's, you know, huge helicopter drops of money to this year's and next year's ginormous sucking plug hole of disappearing fiscal money. And there's a chart here we've got from SocGen, which shows you the magnitude of it. I mean, it's 5 or 6% of GDP coming up in the next 12 months, it's just going to be sucked away by the base effect alone. Now, this is transpiring amid the reopening of the private sector economy, so it's not going to kill the economy stone dead, but it's certainly going to slow growth a lot, and probably, very likely, end the inventory cycle, which will blow back on China's growth as well. Excuse me.
Let me jump in while you're coughing away. Is some of the other so we saw a bunch of stimulus checks sent out to US consumers over the course of the last year, and we got the last batch of those earlier on this year. There's not another batch coming, or not another batch planned, certainly at the moment. You need quite a big growth shock before I think you'd see any traction there. The last one sort of ran into a number of people, a reasonable number of politicians suggesting maybe this, they'd already gone too far and they didn't need to do that last round. So, getting another round of that.
I think the cryptocurrency market would probably agree with that, I think, at the moment. But just on that, so obviously, COVID's still a very real part of life in most, in particularly New South Wales. Hello to our Sydney siders that are listening in. Do you think the markets are pricing in more stimulus because, this Delta variant's going to come through, vaccination rates are high in some countries and not high in others, probably tipped to not be very high in, countries like the US unless the Republicans decide to side with the vaccinators?
Yeah, the US is already pretty well vaccinated.
Yeah.
Their rates are... So certainly there's a lot of states where it's when they're talking about low, it's not low relative to other countries.
Yeah.
Like if you're Australia, we'd be ecstatic with the vaccination rates in the worst countries.
Yep.
Worst states.
Yep. Okay.
Of the US. So but
I mean that's one of our offsets that we're coming up to
Okay.
well. There will be more stimulus. There already is in Australia and elsewhere, but
it's going to be more limited than what it was.
Very much so.
Okay,
yes.
That's what I was going to say.
I mean, the real story here for the year ahead is normalization. It's not more stimulus. So, so you put together this US fiscal cliff with a consumer that has lots of savings, but is probably going to remain pretty cautious. The evidence is that the services rebound in the US is underperforming hopes to some extent because it doesn't quite work the same as goods inventory or pent-up demand, like when you're missing goods, you haven't been able to buy goods for for a while, you've literally developed a deficit that you need to fill, whereas the services are more discretionary and you don't necessarily need to catch up as much. And so it looks like the consumer recovery is going to disappoint a little. And so you put fiscal cliff together with that and fading inventory cycle on the supply side. And so you're going to get a pretty decent slowdown in the US into the end of this year and then further into 2022. So in effect, what you've got is the two largest, single economies, Europe's largest continental, but single country economies in the world, converging on a slowdown as we head into the end of this year. And we have, very pumped up markets at the same time. So obviously that sets up a bit of a disjunction. So before we get to how those two things may or may not work together, let's have a look at the offsets, because there are some quite good ones and big ones. And the first one is that the European vaccine rollout has really accelerated and is going very well. And as we're seeing in the UK, the signs are good for reopening. And so that's going to trigger the kind of reopening boom that we've seen already in the US and China. And that's going to lift European demand to the benefit of all, although less than some other countries, simply because it's less of a domestically demand structure. But still, very good. Nice big boom going there. Some of the EMs as well, emerging markets, like for instance, India, where Delta has just kind of ripped through it, they'll also be rebounding. Southeast Asia is very constrained at the moment by Delta and South America as well. Now, those things are going to take longer to play out, I think. They're still going to be, kind of thrown between lockdowns and vaccine rollouts longer than others. But there will be, it's probably as bad as it's going to get right now, even if it stays at the bottom of the barrel for some time as they kind of, bumble their way through towards some form of herd immunity or another. And as we're already seeing in both China and the US, despite the push towards normalization, there are going to be attempted policy flips, bits and pieces here and there that will try to stop markets getting upset or normalization taking accelerating too fast in a way that upsets the reflation in general. So as we've already mentioned, we've seen the reserve ratio cut in China, very likely to see more of that, as well as, kind of plunge protection teams and various other little measures, all of which will very likely fail. For the reason we already described, which is really the Chinese economy, the way it's structured now, can only fly higher when the throttle is fully open. The moment you close it a little, it starts falling. And then we have a Fed that's definitely moving towards a taper, but, last night was a really interesting experiment in central bank communication from the Fed, where we had a reasonably hawkish push towards taper discussion in its statement, and then Jay Powell got on the microphone and was a cat on a hot tin roof, jumping all around trying to reassure and tell everyone they won't move too fast, and there's more water to pass under the bridge, a ways to go, as he said, before they do anything, and he really did look hyper paranoid about upsetting anybody. Then finally, we've got the new Biden boom, which is being developed around infrastructure, human and hard, which looks like it'll be somewhere between $3 and $4 trillion. But that, as Damo mentioned, takes time to roll out. It's not shovel ready, and so we really don't see that start to impact growth positively until the second half, probably of next year. And then it does make a nice material contribution to US growth for the next 5 or 6 years after that. Maybe adding 0.5% to 1% to US growth, which is terrific for the world and the US. It's very much needed. But in the interim, there is this growth air pocket as we kind of hand the baton from one fiscal regime to the next. So there are some offsets there, and I should underline at this point that the base case, we still think, is is that, you know, definitely in terms of global growth, the base case is very strongly that, you know, we bumble through. We're slow, but overall global growth will be fine. And
I think as part of that, as you're saying, David, is it's we're slow, but governments will come out and start supporting in terms of spending more, and there'll be more fiscal stimulus and more central bank stimulus, because we have to keep coming back to this whole idea that markets aren't normal at the moment. Mm. We're being supported by governments, we're being supported by central banks, and so it's policy error is our biggest risk. Yep. And so what we're sort of saying is, you know, you have this slowing. The number one thing we're watching for is policy error, which is if you started seeing central banks going, no, inflation's starting to break out and growth's going to come back, roaring back, so we're not going to do anything, or we're going to keep tapering or raise rates or whatever, and you had governments doing the same thing, then that's a setup for quite a disastrous event.
Yeah.
But I guess when David's saying bumble through, it's that things start to slow down, but there's offsets and there's basically... there's enough support that investors can look and say, yeah, look, governments and central banks still have our backs, and so therefore we can look across that growth chasm, and as they did for most of last year, and just look at the upside.
Do you think that's material though? So I was just saying, do you think that's material? So like obviously we're talking about some short to medium term headwinds, but then you've got, say, well, if you use the, you know, just focusing on the US, it's like, okay, well, look, things are problematic potentially in the short term, but the big Biden stimulus is going to come sailing through and save the day. You know, is that? Do you think that's insurance or insulation enough to stop, you know, a market pullback in the meantime? X obviously, you know, policy error, is it, you know,
a market catastrophe?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep. Okay.
But it's very much a view that that central banks and governments, you know, if you saw the markets fall 10 or 15%, that there'll be a bit of a panic and a you know, reversal,
big unwinding,
and more money spending, and
yep.
And you know, what else can we do to keep growth?
I might say I think there's two policy, there's policy error and then there's policy disjunction. You know, like, for instance, what China is endeavouring to do is the right thing for it to do right now, which is, you know, it does need to rebalance its economy and it does need to get away from this debt-led investment model. And if it wants to, you know, continue to lift prosperity, it needs to do all of these things. So the policymakers are doing the right thing. The problem is that... To get us through a number of crises culminating in the pandemic, central banks have for years elevated asset prices globally. Mm-hmm. And so what is potentially a policy error for markets, or what is appropriate policy for an economy or a nation may in fact be a policy error for markets. It's the disjunction between the pricing and those macro outcomes that's the problem. Mm-hmm. So this is why policy error becomes a possibility, because, you know, policymakers are doing the right thing in many cases. Normalization is the right thing for the US and the Australian policy as well as we get on top of the virus. But again, you know, that asset in, inflated assets of the various different economic models may prove untenable with sensible policy. So you have, you know, you actually do have inertia in the possibility of a policy error, especially in China, I think, mm-hmm. where the impulse to do the right thing is actually quite strong. So you know, that's why we're doing this poddy, I guess, is because that policy error possibility is real. Mm. Now,
it's probably worth saying as well, though, Dave. There's a strong correlation between what's good for stock markets and what's good for property markets in terms of keeping property prices high. And there's so much debt behind that property market in certainly, well, Australia and China, is that there's a little bit of, if you if you let the asset markets fall away too quickly, then you'll probably find property markets are falling away, which might actually then end up in a bigger problem.
Yeah.
Like in the real
economy. Doom loop.
Yeah, yeah, fair enough. Yes, there's that risk as well. Like it's not all just policy based. It's balance sheets and other things too. Yes. But I mean, at the end of the day, my only point is that there are real values and national interest goals and political goals in some of the normalization process that we're seeing. And so it's still not always just a simple case of just, you know, throw the market what it wants. So there is risk of policy error. That's what I'm saying. Mm. Especially in China, simply because I think they have let that particular model that you're talking about, Damo, where you are, you know, you're so leveraged to your leverage, if you'll pardon the expression, that you really do risk a disaster if you attempt to fix it. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
But what's the end of that story, though, look like? It's just pile it on.
Well, let's have a look at it. I mean, for the time being, right, China is this falling aircraft, right? And we've been through this before three or four times where it starts to lose altitude, and they do the same thing every time. They'll try many different little things to get an updraft under their wings, and they will all fail. But they will try them. Mm. They won't just flip because they know that the long-term consequences are dire as well if they don't fix it.
Yep. You know,
it is a bind that they're in. And so for the time being, therefore, you know, we'll see more reserve ratio cuts. I think we'll see interest rate cuts before this deleveraging cycle is over in China. I think we'll actually have proper monetary easing. The amount of stress that they're kind of building into their property sector at the moment will give them little choice. And that implies a falling yuan before very long as well. In fact, it already looks like it's rolled over. So that's the first kind of asset class to think about in this discussion, is the likelihood while these two convergences transpire is that the Chinese yuan's going to fall and the Australian dollar is by and large attached to it. So the Australian dollar is very likely to remain weak until we get some resolution on this risk case for a fear the growth scare scenario. And you don't actually have to get all the way into that growth scare for these currencies to be still falling. You know, they're going to be start pricing it. That's the whole point of it. As well as that, once you start getting a falling yuan, that really sets up a bad dynamic for emerging markets in general, especially if you're also starting to get a tightening US, which is where we're headed. You know, and tightening these days, forget about interest rate hikes. That's the stuff of fantasy. when, you know, tightening these days is how many bonds are they buying or not buying? Is it QE or QT, quantitative easing or quantitative tightening? And the Fed, you know, the US economy is recovering. Its labor market is tightening. We still don't think there's any cause for concern about inflation, but the Fed has enough governors that do that it is going to push towards tapering before the end of this year. Now, that's going to give you a stronger US dollar. And if that's happening at the same time as China is still tightening and its airplane is falling, and maybe it's just easing back from that tightening a little, but the plane keeps falling, then a rising US dollar and a falling yuan is just a shocking setup for emerging markets. They'll get belted because markets start to realize that capital is going to flow out of emerging markets and interest rates rise there. You know, with the rising US dollar, while at the same time China's getting more competitive against them because of its falling currency, and so they're going to get hit on that front. Chinese growth is always also in question. So commodities are falling, and that's a big part of EM exports. So this is, we've been talking about this now for 6 months, where there's a possibility of an EM bust coming out of post-COVID normalization. And that's kind of the core of a growth scare here. And so getting into some of the other asset classes, while this process transpires and before the stick save comes in, right, you're going to see the bond curve keep flattening, which, you know, is upsetting all of the bond bears out there, I know, who are freaked out by inflation and want the curve to steepen. But it keeps flattening, and this is why. It's not particularly delta. It's not the technicals of the market. It's because we're heading into a macro setup where the China and the US are tightening simultaneously. And this is what happens when you get liquidity draining from both markets at once. The bond curve starts to get smashed. And so until you see the stick saves in both China and the US, or sense them coming, longer duration bonds are going to be a buy, and then that then kind of gives you some hints about the factor, you know, the equity factors that will be in play in stocks. So you know, it's going to be more defensive over cyclicals and value and duration, and we're already seeing that in the US, where the FANGs are back big time. You know, they boomed last year. As we went through a huge deflation shock, then they got smashed earlier this year as we went through the inflation panic. Now we're going back into a deflationary period, which may or may not become an actual growth scare. That's the question we're addressing today. But whilst that question is there, and whilst that question is resolved, then those FANGs are going to fly, and they are. Incidentally, if we do end up tipping into a growth scare, then of course they'll probably correct with everything else. So I summarize that as the base case is we bumble through. What really matters here is how quickly policymakers panic, especially in China, but certainly in the case of the Fed as well, before or as the Chinese emerging market contagion blows back into stocks. And we're already starting to see the stress factors that make that happen, like things like emerging market junk bonds are starting to roll over. These are, you know, we've seen various little growth shock days in the stock market. But the real key here is we're seeing this credit stress in these core sectors in the Chinese market, and Chinese equities getting absolutely blasted on the back of those. So they're all signals telling you that we're heading for some kind of growth scare. And the question is, how quickly does it cause policymakers to panic and go for their stick save with more credit in China and the Fed backing off its taper? At which case, you know, it would be buy with both hands.
Yeah. Mm. And I guess the short version at the moment is we're not close to either of those at the moment.
No.
China could pivot probably a lot more quickly.
Yep.
But as Dave said, you know, last night, the Fed's trying to do everything, but their official notes were certainly, we're starting to look at taper and how we're getting out of this, even though he did speak about saying, well, so that they've sort of got to do a bit of a 180 there, which is, yep, which will probably take a bit longer than you'll either need some big negative events and markets actually to push them to that stage, or you need just a grind out of months of just still weak data before they say, okay, well, actually, maybe we do need to spend more on getting this going. But I think our thoughts are you're probably going to need markets to give them a bit of a push,
yep,
to get them to do it. And that's that part where if they don't do it, you could open the trapdoor beneath the markets. But if they do it quite quickly when markets start giving a push, then you could see that, you know, you're all over and done, and you're onto this next, looking forward at that, at the next growth cycle and where that's coming from.
Yeah, I mean, the best analogy for this, I think, is 2015.
Right.
This is precisely what we saw in 2015.
Yeah.
Where throughout the year, markets were, you know, reasonably robust, although commodities started to fall away, and Chinese growth was fading fast. The US was looking to tighten as it came out of, finally came out of the GFC period, and that culminated in, you know, a pretty decent sell-off at the end of the year, and in what kind of colloquially became known as the Shanghai Accord, where the Fed agreed to back off tapering and the Chinese agreed to stimulate the shit out of their old economy again. Not that it was necessarily an explicit agreement, although I think there was a meeting between the Fed and the PBOC, which is why in Shanghai, which is why it was called the Shanghai Accord. I might have the specifics on that wrong.
But they weren't official. It wasn't like here's an official press release coming out of that saying this is what we're going to do. It was just all very quiet.
It was all rumored and quiet. But you know, that's the sort of dynamic that's in play here and the possible reversal. And obviously it would be much less collegial this time around if it did happen. But, you know, if it's in the interests of both nations, or more to the point, their elites and governments, then, you know, it will transpire anyway. So, you know, that's the analogy. The thing is, this time around, it is different to the extent that we have, you know, various other areas of the global economy opening up. Plus, we'll have the prospect of the Biden stimulus. And so, you know, there are other growth drivers that the market can look forward to that can support looking across this valley.
Okay.
But whether it can or not, you know, that's in the lap of the gods. Yeah.
I would say
at minimum, we're looking at a pretty decent commodity shakeout.
Yep.
Which is why we're quite underweight miners, despite the fact that they're, you know, for the time being, enjoying the fruits of the COVID reopening.
Actually, that's a good segue into our portfolios, Damien and David, and the reflections on, I guess, maybe, as you mentioned, that things probably don't need to be done right now, but what's happening in our portfolios to resonate these themes?
We sort of put most of the things through about probably 2 months ago, two or 3 months ago within this play. So we'd sort of always treated this coming inflation scare as something we needed to lean into, but not sort of jump fully on board. So we were underweight a number of the sectors that were going to do quite well, resources and banks and a lot of value stocks and cyclicals. And so like saying, okay, we need to reduce our underweights to those and, you know, in a few select sectors, pick up some overweights.
Mm-hmm.
So that as the growth scare, as the inflation scare came, we didn't fall behind the market. And so that was sort of done. And then as the scare came, we then started rolling back into our sort of preferred exposure towards going here, which is a mixture of a few different things. But one, it's sort of a bit of a barbell portfolio. And what I mean by that is we're taking some quite low risks at one end and some higher risks at the other end.
Mm-hmm.
Not extreme, but we're sort of balancing out those two. And so on one side, we have a lot of sort of the more growth names like the FANG stocks and those ones and what we call quality growth. So growth stocks that actually are making money and have some reasonable valuations.
Yep.
And then at the other end, a lot of defensive stocks that are interest rate sensitive and will then sort of hold up that end of the portfolio. And so that's sort of our target. We've been letting our equity weights drift down.
Mm.
For a bit of safety bit, but it's, you know, if we got a bit of a growth shock and we, you know, the markets took 10-15% off quite quickly, and you saw central banks and governments starting to step in, we've got a decent amount of firepower to then start throwing more into that trade and looking for that upside on the other side.
Okay.
I guess the danger is that from a relative performance is that markets bumble through more effectively than what we're thinking, and we're sort of a little bit underweight.
Mm-hmm.
But so it's a matter of trying to balance how underweight we are versus the market. But we think in that case, we're still going to perform, you know, we're not going to be far behind the market under that scenario. But if we're starting to look more at this growth scare becoming a real a base case rather than a risk case as mm-hmm. it is at the moment, then we'd be certain taking some more off on the equity side. And the other thing to think about as well is that, you know, the When we're saying it's a risk case, it's not a tail risk. You know, here's a lottery chance of this might happen. This is a significant tail risk in terms of, I don't know, 20% to 40%.
Wow.
You know, in terms of that as a probability. So it's well worth. It's our number one sort of check on a daily basis of every new bit of data and economic data and company data that comes out. It's a right. Compare that back to our thoughts on this. Is there any sign that our growth scares more likely?
Yep.
And so whether that means we need to wind back or wind up.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah. And I mean, to the extent that, you know, where the various tilts we've got and factors that we see affecting equities, it's a much higher risk case for some than others. Like, as I say, at minimum, we see this being a commodity accident. Like, the risk on for miners, therefore, is much higher than it is, for instance, for tech stocks.
Mm.
Because, you know, the likelihood is that the slowing and the popping of the inventory cycle will be enough to deflate a lot of those markets, regardless of whether the broader equity market manages to bumble through.
Sure. Okay. Yep, no worries. Just one last one as well. So, just we've obviously spoken a lot about China and the US, and thought of mine. So, so obviously, it appears anyway. So if we go, let's give our mind back to the Trump era, whether or not he actually had a lot to play a part in the enormous, you know, stratospheric sort of rise in the equity markets in the US, or whether or not he just decided to claim it, and it was just. Do you feel that Biden has a sort of a similar view? So in terms of, you know, a focus on, you know, maintaining high equity prices going forward, or do you think he's more centered on the actual economy itself and running it? So, and you know, it kind of felt in a way that Trump in a way was sort of protective perhaps a little bit, or that was the messaging he put out anyway.
I think he treated it as a bit of an opinion poll on his performance. But look, you know, that he put through some major tax cuts for companies.
Yep.
And so that was a huge boom for just in terms of an earnings perspective. Yep. So you just picked up you know, massive amount of earnings in that. And pumping a lot of money into an economy, got things going, got unemployment right down.
Mm-hmm.
And so in terms of the genuine profit, you know, growth that was backing up the rise in the stock market.
Yep.
So whether it was sustainable, and you know, can you tax cut your way to prosperity and all these, there's a whole bunch of questions about that.
Sure.
But certainly very much in the short term, you give companies a lot more money and give them big tax cuts, you'll see the stock market rise.
What do you know?
Yep. Now Biden's taking a different view though. He's taking what you'd call more of a long-term perspective on this, which is, yeah, that's a great sugar rush, and you can get a couple of years out of it, but that's not the recipe for long-term success. Mm-hmm. The recipe for long-term success is you've got to get the benefits more equally spread out. Mm-hmm. And we keep talking about this whole inequality part. Your richest person gets another $1,000, they throw it on the pile and they invest it, which means markets go up, and whether it's asset prices in houses or stock markets, they all go up.
Mm-hmm.
You give that money to the poorest person and they get out and actually spend the money on consumer goods and they get it out and that actually sort of grows the overall economy.
Yep.
So if you want to grow asset markets in the short term, you give lots of money to people who are already rich.
Yep.
And that will drive asset prices up in the short term, but you'll have this long-term problem of your consumption keeps falling away, you have weak demand, you get deflation, all the things we've seen over the last 10 years or so.
Yep, sure.
And so Biden's plans and policies are trying to be more supportive, mm-hmm, of that equality side. They're still limited by what they can do politically.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not I'm not sort of looking at his plans going, this is it, this is Nirvana, it's going to solve all these problems, and you know, that's the world's going to be a much better place. His plans though aren't making the inequality worse, and there's a reasonable chance they'll make the inequality a little bit better. Mm. But they're certainly not not back to the same phase as we were in, you know, 30, 40 years ago. It's still at the margin. It's at least things aren't getting worse, and they might get if he gets all this stuff through he wants, they might get incrementally better, which will provide a better base and a longer term outlook for markets.
Okay, no worries. And then just to flip it over, thanks for that. On the Chinese side, and obviously we don't have a lot of coverage in Chinese equity markets, but
we're starting to look at Chinese equity markets
been some pretty significant impacts and on some recent rule changes and bits and pieces that the Chinese government that lend to me to say that the Chinese government actually thinks that, you know, their equity market is a bit of an afterthought really in their policy making decisions as opposed to perhaps on the Western side?
Look, I think there's a few things with the to keep in mind with the Chinese equity market. Is one of them is that the stocks you have listed, the stocks that are listed in the US, the big ones, the Alibabas and the Tencents and those ones that have these US exposures, it's a very curious regulatory environment in which they've been listed.
Okay.
You know, according to the laws of, if you strictly enforce the laws of both the US and China, these companies wouldn't, or China, sorry, these countries wouldn't be, companies wouldn't be listed. So Chinese, there's restrictions on what foreigners can actually own in terms of it. On the other side, the US requires companies to be independently audited to be able to be listed on these. And Chinese companies aren't independently audited. And
right.
China has specifically said they won't be independently audited.
Yep.
And so so what happens is there's this, there's these vehicles that sit in the Cayman Islands somewhere or some sort of tax haven that have this vague promise from these Chinese companies to give them all their profits.
Right.
And then they're the ones that these US investors own that sort of have this. And so it's this, I guess everyone's made a decision that this is all right. We can handle this.
Right.
But at any stage, if the US said, okay, we're just going to enforce our laws, you know, everything needs to be independently audited, the Chinese government will go, well, these things can't be independently audited because we don't want you looking in the books.
Yeah.
And so they can't be listed there. Vice versa, you could have China say, you know what, we're going to enforce our rules and say that foreign investors can't own.
Yep.
And this is just a dodgy way of getting around it, and we're pulling it down.
Okay.
So we have this this agreement to keep the charade up, and so that's sort of one part that's behind the whole that's there. There's this overarching legal issue that you have in terms of buying into
getting access
if you're buying these shares and what it would mean if that got removed. Then you have a number of sort of high profile Chinese entrepreneurs who China look upon as being getting too powerful and creating issues for them as the sole power within China.
Yep.
And so there's sort of rules they're putting on about making sure that doesn't happen. Now we've had the thing with the educational stocks where they're basically trying to
govern them or legislate
just regulate them.
Yeah, regulate
yeah.
them.
And so, I think there's sort of a convergence of all these, plus the Chinese developers, which have got these three red lines on it, which is all sort of going, sort of forcing things down.
Mm.
And stock market ownership is much lower in China.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not going to affect the economy as much. And so I think there's a, my guess is they would prefer the stock market to be higher rather than lower.
Yep.
But they've got bigger issues they're trying to solve, and they prefer to solve these other issues of maintaining power and maintaining sort of economic growth within China.
Yep.
That they're content to let the Chinese stock market fall to a certain extent, and then before you know there's a certain backstop that they will sort of put in.
Okay.
They're trying to do a little bit of that backstopping at the moment. But David spoke about the plunge protection team, which is basically just trying to talk the market up.
Yeah, gotcha.
And so
and those pressure release pauses they do on trading and things like that.
Occasionally
they just stop the market and say everyone have it, go and have a cup of coffee and come back and we can resume play.
Yeah, that's right. So I guess our view is that investing in Chinese stocks is fraught with a range of risks that you don't see, and whether it's geopolitical risks or legal risks or all these other things that sort of sit with it that you just don't see in other stocks. And so if for anyone who is looking at this and saying, oh, I'm going to use the chance to buy the dip on this, you need to be across the situation and realize that there's a lot of risk within that. So and then there's the other part of a lot of these are you know, very much governed by the central authorities there. When they get fined by these big amounts, often the company thanks the regulator for bringing the error of their ways to their attention and
yep.
and paying. So there's, and companies might be required to buy other companies or to support, you know, make loans that they might not have otherwise made, sort of by the direction of governments. So
yeah,
they may, you know, that as a shareholder you might not be the in Western countries board decisions and everything are meant to be there for the, yeah. for the benefit of shareholders.
Yeah, sure.
That's not the case in China.
Mm.
You know, it might be more that, well, shareholders in particular companies are just going to have to take one for the team because the Chinese government would like to, whatever.
Do this rule. Or
control data more.
Yeah.
You know, make sure that they keep power in their own country, whatever it is.
Yep.
And so.
And you need to price that risk accordingly if you're investing in China.
Absolutely.
All right. Very good. All right. Well, thanks for your time today, Damien. Unfortunately, Dave's just had to shoot off as well, just while Damien was answering that very full answer to a good question there. So, thanks again. And we've got our question of the week as well. So I'll jump over to that one. So today if you'd like, just drop in your answers, of course, into the comments and the YouTube chat boxes. We always like to read those. How likely do you think there is a growth scare coming, given the information here, or in fact anything else that you may be considering topic-wise or macroeconomic narrative-wise as well? We always enjoy reading those. On that note, thanks again for all of those, of course, who've watched in for another great episode. And I hope you have taken away some great ideas. And if you haven't already, feel free to click like on the video now to give us some feedback. If you'd like to see more of our content, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. To stay up to date on news from us, follow us on social media. And finally, if you know anyone who'd get something out of today's episode, let them know about it, share with a friend, and help our show grow. Thanks again for tuning in. From myself, Tim Fuller, signing off for the last time on Nucleus Investment Insights. I'd like to personally thank everyone for following our terrific show over the years. It's been a power of work to put together. And I do wish Mark and the team all the best in bringing our insights to you in the future. So on that note, cheerio from me, and the rest of the team will look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.